Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show. I'm your host, Phil Huff, this morning, and it's a glorious Tuesday in September, the very first one, September 3rd. And to get right to it, this is the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act. It was on September 3rd in 1964 that Lyndon Johnson signed the act into law with these words: "If future generations are to remember us with gratitude rather than contempt, we must leave them with something more than the miracle of technology. We must leave them with a glimpse of the world as it was in the beginning." And thus began the Wilderness Act. This path-breaking legislation marked the first time that any nation had called upon the power of law to mandate a selection of places to be left undeveloped, where nature should dominate. So today with us, we have two people to celebrate with: Doug Scott, longtime well-known wilderness author, activist, and advocate, formerly with the Pew Public Lands Group, the Wilderness Society, and Sierra Club, author of The Enduring Wilderness, and has visited Sandpoint in the past. Some avid listeners may recognize him from previous trips to our area to talk about the wilderness. Also, we have Neil Clark, the Wildlands Director for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, one of the organizers of the Emerging National Wilderness Coalition. We're going to hear a lot more about that. Welcome to the show this morning, Doug, and welcome, Neil.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
So let's start, Doug, let's start with you. Give us a little bit of a deeper dive on your background. I've done the basic bio, but tell listeners a little bit more about yourself and how you came to work for Wilderness, and then we'll do the same with Neil.
I had the good fortune to fall into wilderness advocacy with the Wilderness Society while I was finishing graduate school, and ended up on a plane ride in a raging blizzard to far northern Michigan to testify on behalf of wilderness protection for Isle Royale National Park, one of the great wilderness areas in our country. And I just got hooked. And as soon as I finished grad school and I was off to Washington, started with the Wilderness Society in the 1980s, I moved on to, the 1970s, I moved on to the Sierra Club, first in heading the Seattle regional office, and ultimately in the headquarters in San Francisco as the conservation director. To me, wilderness, in addition to being the strongest possible form of protection for the wildest of our federal lands, a designation only Congress can apply, is about the people. For there are stories of people just like Phil and Neil behind every acre that has been protected in our wilderness system by Congress. And these are people from every walk of life. They have some place of federal land that they love. They may hike or fish or hunt, and they want to see it given the strongest possible protection. And they come to learn that relying on any kind of administrative protection is simply inadequate. Wilderness is important because it lasts. The rationale, the reason for wilderness protection is to protect the land in its wildest form and in perpetuity, which is a fancy word for forever.
Well, good. We're going to get a lot more into that very quickly here, Doug. First, let's hear a little bit from Neil about your background, how you came to work for SUA and came to advocate for wilderness and what it means to you.
Sure. I grew up in the flatlands of Ohio, not a heavy wilderness or public lands part of the country, but had a fateful moved to Colorado for a summer, trying to get out of Ohio for a while, and really had the light bulb went off as far as public lands and wilderness. And it really changed the entire trajectory of my life. My whole academic focus and career focus at that point forward was really around public lands and particularly wilderness, working on wilderness advocacy and wilderness protection. I ended up leaving Ohio, moving out west, going to grad school, continuing to focus on these issues. And when you're in the, when you learn about the wilderness community, you know, the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance has a long and storied reputation in the wilderness movement. And I started working with them. I was fortunate enough to get a job with the organization, and I've really just been focused on this work in Utah ever since for the past 13 years now.
Mm-hmm. I will say on a personal note, if there's one place that I always felt embodied the literal heartbeat of the West, it had to be that Four Corners area, including and especially that southeastern part of Utah. It's just fabulous. So, thank you for joining us both today. Let's start with the beginning. The wilderness took some time. Doug, in addition to your many works with wilderness, I know you as a historian, and give us a bit of the history about the Wilderness Act and how it came together.
Well, it came together because of complete dissatisfaction by the leaders of the then very small national conservation movement, the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society. And they had had experience which showed them that they simply could not rely on the promises of administrative agencies like the Forest Service and the National Park Service to properly protect areas of the wildest portions of the lands which for which they had responsibility. With the Forest Service, this took the shape of the boundaries constantly moving around. I was privileged to be at the 100th anniversary celebration earlier this year for the Gila Wilderness, which is in southeast New Mexico. It was the very first wilderness area designated in 1924 by administrative action. But before many years were over, the Forest Service decided there was some reason to bisect the Gila Wilderness by cutting it in two with a new road. And there was no reason for the road, but the Forest Service had the entire discretion to do that. And that and other examples, notably with slicing a huge chunk of old growth forests out of the side of the Three Sisters Wilderness in Central Oregon, again, an administratively protected Forest Service area. And despite the opposition of the entire Oregon congressional delegation, and it was up to the Secretary of Agriculture, and the Secretary of Agriculture said, go ahead. And the leaders of the Wilderness Societies, Howard Zonizer, and the Sierra Club, David Brower, just were, to them, this was utterly unacceptable. In the case of the national parks, the powerful Western water interests decided it would be a good idea to build a huge dam that would back a reservoir into the heart of a national park in on the Utah-Colorado border, and a place called Echo Park. And there was no reason for this. For this dam, other than the desire of the powerful Western water interest to create that reservoir and regulate the flow of the Colorado River, that was a pivotal moment in the history of wilderness for the Wilderness Society and the Sierra Club, which were then very small, managed to block the legislation, first one year in the Senate and the next year in the House and back and forth. And finally, the Colorado congressional delegation had to give up and remove that dam and insert instead a provision saying there never would be a dam built in a unit of the national park system. But the Park Service was powerless to have stopped that. if it hadn't been for the citizen movement. I'm a student of this history, and I just extol the courage that it took when there were very few resources. You didn't just jump on an airplane and fly off to around the country in those days. The Wilderness Act was intended for a single purpose: to cut off the discretion of agency officials to fool around with the boundaries or to allow any non-wilderness development within areas that were covered by wilderness designation. Think of it as an extra layer sitting on top of national parks, national wildlife refuges, national forests, and lands administered by the Bureau of Land Management,
but with all that,
mostly in the West.
With all that energy, the activists took to the halls of Congress to get a law passed, and that took some number of years and some tries, didn't it?
Yes, it wasn't. It took 8 years because there was a great deal of fussing about the details. It passed the Senate in 1962, but it was blockaded by the powerful committee chair in the House, who had something he wanted, and until he was accommodated, he just barred the way. And finally, his demands were accommodated. And that's what led to the law reaching the desk for President Johnson to sign.
And there were compromises. Having walked through the Gila, and it's a fabulous place, I was distressed by the number of cows right along the Gila River. And so cattle grazing being a prime example of one of the accommodations that was necessary in order to get the original Wilderness Act passed.
Absolutely. And it's in the nature of our political system that legislation requires compromise. But wilderness advocates have long memories. And if some area has to be left out of a boundary, they're gonna turn their energies. So they're gonna protect what they can, and then turn their energies back to building more grassroots support in that local area to get additions. Most of the areas in our wilderness system in the lower 48 have been expanded. One has been expanded five times. And again, you take off the table by accepting what you can get, and then turn your energy back to the next increment.
Well, that's a good segue to the fact that the original Wilderness Act, when passed, established a certain number of areas as wildernesses, about 54 of them in 13 states and a little over 9 million acres. And more importantly, Doug, and you should tell us a little bit more about this, it really set up a system whereby Congress could bring in additional areas to really create a more robust wilderness preservation system.
Well, that's right. In the first 10 years, the National Forest, the Forest Service and the National Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service were required to study a number of areas. It was 54 so-called primitive areas in the National Forest, all the roadless areas in the National Park System of 5,000 acres or more, and all the roadless areas are 5,000 acres or more in the National Wildlife Refuges. Among my very favorite wilderness areas is one that's 30 miles from Times Square in suburban New Jersey called the Great Swamp Wilderness, which was the very first wilderness to be added after the Wilderness Act became law.
And many more have been added since then. Bring us
many
up.
Many more. Today there are 806 wilderness areas, and covering an area of 111 plus million acres, including a vast area of 57 million plus in Alaska, which came in 1980. And in 1976, Congress added the Bureau of Land Management to the scheme of the wilderness system. And it is, those lands are in tough territory, like where Neil works, tough politically, but slowly but surely, more areas are being added to the wilderness system. I don't believe they'll ever become an end to the growth of the system of wilderness areas, because there's always somebody who has a favorite place that hasn't yet gotten this most secure form of legal protection.
It does seem to have taken some cycles, and with the direction towards the agencies to study lands that were suitable, then that created a process in the 70s that's left us with the roadless areas we know today. Then Congress took to acting in the 1980s, Doug. That was a pretty robust decade. Tell us a little more.
Well, it wasn't because the Forest Service wanted to do it. It was because they had bungled administrative study of roadless lands in across the national forest system, east and west. Congress, with particularly the leadership of Senator Frank Church, who was a dear friend of mine, Democrat of Idaho, chaired the subcommittee that handled such things in the Senate. These laws were passed in 1984 for many states in order to essentially discipline the Forest Service for the bungling it had done in properly studying and considering recommending designation of additional areas. Administrative agency leaders do not want to surrender one inch of their administrative discretion to do things and to build things. It's just the nature of, and I say that admiring many of those people who I've known and worked with. But the Wilderness Act is all about taking away their discretion.
Mm-hmm. So where does it all go from here? We're celebrating a bunch of anniversaries this year, not just the 60th. There's about 20 other wilderness bills that have anniversaries ranging in years. So there's been a fair number added and some significant ones. We've talked about the 80s. The expansion into the east in the 70s is something I think for you to touch on, Doug.
Well, first of all, the original Wilderness Act actually included three national forest wilderness areas in the eastern states. The Forest Service then thought up the cute trick of pretending that lands that had ever been touched by the hand of man, their so-called purity doctrine, could never be protected under the Wilderness Act. Well, this was complete hokum, and we ended up, and the reason they did this, and I was in the room when Senator Church said to the chief of the Forest Service, "Oh, I think I understand now. This purity thing isn't about limiting wilderness areas in the east. It's about limiting wilderness areas in the west. How high up the mountainside the boundaries must be, and you would have them be way up above timberline so you could get out all the logs. And that's not You just do the studies and you bring your recommendations, and we here in Congress will be the ones who will make the decisions, and we will listen to the people."
So the purity test got turned out, and Congress has certainly acted to establish areas where the process of nature is predominant, as was intended.
Well, that very first wilderness area in the Great Swamp is, again, one of my favorites. It's about 4,000 acres. And at the hearing, I was in the room, that crusty old chairman of the committee pointed to the map and asked Secretary of the Interior, Stuart Udall, said, "What's that line dividing this into two areas?" And he said, "Well, that's a road." And the chairman said, "Well, I don't think you can have that road." And local congressman jumped up and said, "Mr. Chairman, if you don't want that road, consider it gone." And it's a gorgeous hiking trail today. They sent some heavy equipment in, already was designated as wilderness, and ripped out the, it was kind of a tarred gravel road, and ripped out that stuff. While they were at it, they filled a drainage canal that had drained the swamp originally. There was a town there and farming, and the water level came back up. Unless you know the story I just told you, you and walked along that trail, you would never know that it had had that history, and it just continues getting wilder and wilder. There's a wilderness area, and I think it's New Hampshire. Again, kind of a bowl, and in the center, there was a town and a sawmill. Hold on. It's in the wilderness system today.
You know, we need look no further than how fast alder grows to take over roads here and to understand that the power of nature to reclaim is really supreme. Where are things headed now, 60 years in, Doug, observing the wilderness movement from the perspective of time as it's matured? How do things sit today, and what are the prospects for the future? And then we'll segue to Neil with the same question.
Well, there's been shifting in the groups that have taken leadership roles, and Neil knows more about that than I do, somebody has always been there to step up. Because wherever there are a group of people, you know, you get the neighbors in, sit around the kitchen table and pull out a map. And that's how these proposals take form. Very frequently, our movement has taken local volunteer leaders to Washington, D.C. to talk to their own members of Congress and others about their advocacy for protecting of these lands. And, you know, you strip it down, most elected officials, members of Congress, want to please their constituents. And some have become, as in the case of Senator Church, have become great personal advocates for areas in their own states that they know very well.
Very good. Well, thank you, Doug. Neil, let's talk a little bit about your experience with SUA and how SUAs fit into this continuum, and then again, where we see things going. But SUA's been active for some time.
Yes, SUA's been around for more than four decades, working really exclusively on wilderness protection for BLM, Bureau of Land Management, public lands in Utah. We focus on a piece of legislation called America's Red Rock Wilderness Act that proposes about 8.2 million acres of wilderness throughout Utah, primarily in southern Utah, and the sort of iconic Red Rock country that people around the globe know and love. You know, a lot of our work is really about protecting these places that are currently unprotected to make sure they continue to qualify as wilderness while we wait for opportunities for both administrative or ideally legislative wilderness designations protections. We also actively work on managing existing wilderness. We have almost a million acres of BLM wilderness in Utah now. And so we're actively working with the agencies to make sure those areas are both the management is implemented in the right way and that they continue to be protected moving forward. Because I think many of us realize that once you designate a wilderness area, the work is not done. It requires continual management and attention to make sure that those wilderness values are protected.
So, and we'll dig into the National Wilderness Coalition and the work that you're doing with that right now, but in broad stroke terms, where do you see us going for the current conditions and future of the wilderness movement?
Well, as you said, we'll talk about the coalition, and that's really an effort to try to shape where the wilderness movement is going. I can speak a little bit to where I think the wilderness movement is now, which is that, you know, big picture, wilderness designation is hard. Only Congress can designate a wilderness area, and I think everyone recognizes that in our current political climate, passing any legislation is going to be extremely difficult. The wilderness debate has become very polarized as far as party lines. And in, you know, Utah, where I work, and many places in the West that have the most remaining wild places that are not protected, you have openly hostile congressional delegations that really work to try to undermine not just wilderness efforts, but any public land conservation efforts. That said, we're still passing good wilderness bills. The Dingell Act in 2019 passed wilderness bills throughout the West, including almost 700,000 acres here in Utah. I do think there's been a big focus within the conservation community in recent years, the last 10 years, on alternative designations. This is an outgrowth, really, of the difficulty of passing legislation in Congress. These are designations like national monuments or national conservation areas. And I think while these types of designations are net gains for public lands conservation, they simply don't offer the same level of protection and durability as wilderness, which, you know, as we know, is the gold standard for federal land conservation in the United States. And so I would really like to see the conservation community move towards a more intentional and coordinated focus on passing large wilderness bills, which is, I think, where we've strayed a bit from in recent years.
So I just want to agree with Neil on that point. These other designations are all well and good, but they, in general, they don't carry that essential quality that designation as a wilderness area by Congress does, which is that the boundaries cannot move. You cannot move, if you're the Forest Service or the Park Service or any of the other agencies, you can't, if Congress has set a boundary, you cannot move that boundary by so much as a square foot without another act of Congress. That's why the Wilderness Act is the gold standard.
Thank you, Doug. So how did the National Wilderness Coalition begin? Where did it come from?
It's really, the National Wilderness Coalition is an outgrowth of discussions that really that have been happening for a long time between folks in the wilderness community, but specifically a gathering that happened about a year ago to pull everyone together to try to hash out where the wilderness community is, where is the wilderness movement, and where should it be going. And I think everyone working in this space recognized some of the challenges that we're having, and coming out of that gathering was really a concerted effort and some excitement and enthusiasm around rebuilding a national coalition to really focus on these issues. You know, in light of climate change and biodiversity loss, I all of us feel like wilderness is really the critical tool in the toolbox, but that to move wilderness legislation forward, we really have to focus on expanding the base of support, creating a more diverse and exciting constituency around wilderness and wilderness advocacy. And so the Wilderness Coalition really is an outgrowth of just sort of this, a rebuilding in some ways of a national community pushing for this specific issue.
It sounds very grassroots.
Yeah, I mean, all the organizations involved, you know, there's 30 plus organizations at this point that have been engaged with the coalition are all at their core grassroots organizations that come with extensive, you know, numbers of membership and support. And so it is very much the people on the ground recognizing that we need to have a coordinated effort to make sure we stay relevant, you know, as times are changing and different issues are popping up, and also strong, because if we're not showing up with strength and diversity and real people power, then how do we expect legislators to pick that up and run with it and push for legislation in Congress?
I think this is one of the, to me, interesting things about the wilderness movement in general, and Doug, maybe you can chime in here a little bit, is how it has come to evolve into a process that's included grassroots activism. And at times through the last 60 years, that's been more or less important. And Maybe Doug, you can take us a little bit through the arc of how that's come together.
Well, it's always been crucial. Grassroots activism, diverse support. In my heyday, I was all over the country, dropping out of the sky to get with local leaders and help them lay plans for further in-depth organizing to build that support. And you must have, and you must never set aside lofty goals. And I salute Neil and the work that is going on with the coalition to set those kind of goals and keep them always in mind as you lay the groundwork. No one in and I was right at the heart of it. No one in 1979 or 19 early 70s had any idea that it would be possible to protect 57 million acres of wilderness, including and lots of new national parks and monuments and so forth across Alaska. No one had any idea that a peanut farmer from Georgia named Jimmy Carter was going to come to office with that dream. And it was his leadership and a bipartisan effort from an amazing group of people in Congress that got that legislation passed. And I was in the room when President Carter signed that law in the East Room on December 2nd, 1980, 57 million acres. And I'll tell you what, no one from the Alaska delegation was in favor of it. They were all there, but they looked pretty sour.
And yet, since then, I think they have come to appreciate it. So,
Oh, of course. I mean, Alaska is very large, and there's the same law made available large swaths of Alaska for other forms of use and development, in addition to the portions that were protected for in various conservation designations, including the 57 million acres of wilderness areas.
To me, it seems somewhat intuitive that for Congress to act on lands legislation, they need a voice that is working in a very place-based way. And so there's a role, a reason for grassroots activism and voices. And yet it also seems intuitive, maybe you could both tie this together, that the power of the collective, that individual grassroots voices speaking for their areas are significant, but the real power of the movement comes from the collection of the voices speaking with some unity or at least some sense of common urgency.
That's absolutely correct. It always has been. When there weren't very many voices, and at times when there were controversies that needed to be ironed out, but as long as we have remained true to the fact that mobilizing a stronger and stronger choir was the way to move forward. And if we are stuck in a situation at any particular time politically where we're kind of immobilized, we need to keep the choir tuned up.
Let's come back to the fact that this is the 60th anniversary, and this month, September, as this plays, is a significant month. It's often been celebrated as the National Wilderness Month with a lot of attention and focus on it. Tell us what's happening, Neil. You're involved with some form of organizing some celebrations that are coming up here in DC.
Yeah, the National Wilderness Coalition is hosting an event in September in DC in celebration of the 60th anniversary. We're going to be having some congressional lobbying day, have folks on the Hill talking about wilderness and the importance of wilderness. We're going to celebrate the act, celebrate the folks in Congress who are champions for these issues, hand out some awards to congressional members. And also do some education, have some discussions around the future of the movement, where we think things are going and should be going. Yeah, I think big picture, really, we want to celebrate. You know, it's a great milestone. I think it's important to recognize everyone who's worked throughout history to have these places protected, but also really focusing on where the movement is going and what needs to happen in the next 60 years to continue adding acres to this system and making sure that we're relevant and exciting and something that people want to get behind and support.
Sounds like a lot of good goals. What are the outcomes you're hoping for from next week?
I'm really hoping to, one, just to have a good celebration and yes, build some enthusiasm and some enthusiasm for wilderness. Like I said, really focusing on where we're going. I hope that, you know, we're able to educate congressional members on wilderness and start the process of building some new wilderness champions. I think it's great to, you know, you need to have congressional members who are pushing for specific bills, but the Wilderness Act is also often under attack, and we need to have people in Congress who are wilderness champions generally, who understand the value of wilderness. And so starting that process of educating congressional members and staff, I think recognizing the folks in Congress who are working on these issues is important. And then another component is kind of bringing awareness to the National Wilderness Coalition and the work that we're doing and building some excitement around this movement.
So who are some of the folks going? Who all is involved with this?
I think, as I've said earlier, there's 30 or more organizations who've been involved. Obviously, my organization, the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, it's really state, regional, and national groups. We have everyone from Green Latinos and the Sierra Club, Wilderness Workshop, to more state-based groups like Alaska Wilderness League. It's really a broad swath and I think fairly well encompassing of everyone who's historically been working on this issue. So really excited about how the coalition has come together and really moved forward around this event and the work that we're trying to do in the coming years.
It sounds like a grand old time. Always good for wilderness colleagues to get together and share ideas and energies and enthusiasms and talk about common challenges too and how to confront those. Where does the wilderness movement, where does the National Wilderness Coalitions, more specifically, where do you think it goes after DC? What's next?
I think we're going to have a coming together after we get through this event, which has been a big lift for the coalition, but really focusing on what the next 12 to 16 months look like, what the priorities are going to be for the coalition, really trying to build that bigger tent, which is what everyone who's been involved understands is a big component of building that political power and building that movement to ultimately pass legislation. And so really starting the work of reaching out to groups that maybe are not specifically wilderness advocacy organizations, but are operating in the public land sphere or in the environmental justice sphere, you know, bringing in more voices from the indigenous community and sovereign nations. And so really starting to plan out what it looks like in the next, you know, year to 2 years for really building this movement. And it's long-term work, right? This isn't something that happens overnight, but we have a lot of interest, a lot of buy-in, and a lot of expertise and energy behind it. And so I'm really excited to see where it goes in the next couple of years.
It's an exciting time. We're coming close to the end of the time we have for the interview, but I want to make sure we've got enough time for any final thoughts from each of you. Maybe Doug will give you the chance to close with some final thoughts. So, Neil, anything you'd like to add to the conversation?
Well, I just want to salute Neil and the work of the National Wilderness Coalition. It's obviously greatly needed. There has always been some organization, and it's shifted over time, that has taken the central lead in making sure that the diverse voices of the wilderness movement writ large are mobilized and headed off in the right direction. No wheel spinning needed, but get along with the next level of activities. There are, I haven't been able to look them up this morning when I thought of it, but I'm certain that there are wilderness laws, wilderness legislation that has been introduced in Congress or will be before the end of this Congress, which is this year. For the most part, every Congress since 1964 has added lands to the wilderness system. And I want to say that every president since Lyndon Johnson has signed laws protecting more wilderness areas. Republicans, Ronald Reagan, God help us, Donald Trump. He had absolutely no idea what he was signing, but it was put together in a law that included all manner of recreation and public land progress, not just wilderness, but there was 1.3 million acres of wilderness designation in a law that Donald Trump signed. And he signed it because it had such massive Republican support, because there were things that all sorts of Republican members wanted in that single large bill. And that's something we need to remember how to do.
It's quite a process. I know there's a number of bills that are out there on the floor yet to be acted on. So we have some hope that we'll see some before the end of the year, I believe. Neil, some closing thoughts?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's been so nice to hear Doug talk about the history of the act. And I want to recognize that, you know, the Wilderness Act is 60 years old, and it's not perfect. The way it was written was not, you know, it's reflective of what was written 60 years ago. And I think just acknowledging that everyone in the wilderness movement recognizes that, that there are issues with the act as far as, you know, not recognizing indigenous communities on the land, for example. And that said, though, it also remains a extremely visionary piece of legislation. It's really hard to imagine a bill like that moving forward at this day and age in a lot of ways. And so in light of all of the ecological and societal challenges we have in this country and that we're facing, it's really more important than ever that we continue to build this movement and to protect the remaining wild places that we have in our public land system.
I couldn't agree more. Wilderness holds answers to the questions we have not yet learned to ask, as it's I'm so fond of quoting. To me, it's a absolutely essential thing we must pass on to our kids and grandkids. And before we close, Doug's historical knowledge of trivia. President Johnson's hand was busy this day in the Rose Garden. I believe it was the Rose Garden signing ceremony. He signed two other landmark bills into law 60 years ago on September 3rd. Doug, I'm sure you know what they are.
Well, I do, because I saw them in your outline. One set up the Land and Water Conservation Fund to help states acquire more lands for all manner of conservation purposes, and the other was the National Council on the Arts, I believe.
Yes.
And within a very short time after that, not that day, President Johnson signed the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act and the National Trails Act.
He was very busy that year. A month or two previous, he signed the National Civil Rights Act. It was a robust Congress, and the bills he signed today were largely supported across the board, bipartisan efforts, and the Land and Water Conservation Fund is another great example of how strong that was. I believe to date that it has funded projects in every county in the United States, has benefited in some form or other from monies that have passed through the Land and Water Conservation Fund.
Absolutely. And the wilderness system continues to grow. And that, to me, is a testament to the essentially unstoppable power of grassroots leadership. I salute the National Wilderness Coalition for picking up the leadership at this point in our history.
I want to thank you both, and Neil, a big thank you for helping to spearhead the National Wilderness Coalition and for coming on the show this morning. If you've just tuned in, this is KRFY, and you are listening to The Morning Show. This will be saved as a podcast, so you can listen to any or all of it again at krfy.org. With us this morning in the studios, we celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, is Doug Scott, wilderness author, activist, and advocate. And Neil Clark, Wildlands Director from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and one of the organizers of the National Wilderness Coalition. I want to thank you both, Doug and Neil, for coming in this morning.